Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry Podcast with me, your host, Lily Ehrman. This episode is all about natural history. The practice of natural history is very close to my heart, and I think it can be a powerful gateway to biomimicry. As many of you heard in my first episode and introduction, I fell in love with the natural world at a very young age. And in college, I had the pleasure of attending Natural History Field Quarter at UC Santa Cruz, where I spent an entire semester traveling around California with 20 other students, camping in ecosystems like the Mojave Desert, Eel River, and Santa Cruz Island. Shortly after college, I met my guest today at the High Sierra Natural History Celebration in Tuolumne Meadows, Yosemite, where he was speaking. At the time, Tom Fleischner was the director of the Natural History Institute in Arizona. Not long after meeting him, I happened to move to Phoenix to study and work at ASU. Eventually, I made it to the Institute for a field workshop and even got to host my own biomimicry talk 1 year later. Talk about full circle. Tom Fleischner, a naturalist and conservation biologist, was the founding executive director of the Natural History Institute in Prescott, Arizona, and currently serves as the Institute's senior advisor and director emeritus. He is faculty emeritus at Prescott College, where he taught interdisciplinary environmental studies for 29 years. He is the author of numerous articles and professional papers, and author or editor of 4 books, including The Way of Natural History and Nature, Love, Medicine, Essays on Wildness and Wellness. He co-edited a special issue of the academic journal Ecopsychology on Reciprocal Healing, Nature, Health, and Wild Vitality, and is a fellow of the Linnaean Society of London. Welcome, Tom.
Well, my name is Tom Fleischner. I just a few months ago stepped down from being the founding executive director of the Natural History Institute, which is based in Prescott, Arizona. I now have the somewhat cumbersome title there of senior advisor and director emeritus. I'm also the faculty emeritus at Prescott College, where a small liberal arts college here in Prescott, Arizona, where I taught interdisciplinary environmental studies for 29 years. He, him, his are my pronouns.
Awesome. And so thanks so much, Tom, for joining me today. I'm really excited to jump right in to all things natural history. So my first question for you is, what is natural history and what does it mean to practice natural history?
Okay, well, natural history, which has been sort of the unifying principle of my life and for the last many years, is, I think, a really misunderstood term. I've often asked groups of people I've been speaking with, you know, how if they're familiar with the term, what does it mean to them? And by and large, they're usually a bit puzzled by it, and if they have any associations whatsoever, it tends to be something to do with a museum field trip when they're in sixth grade or something like that. And so I think that the term there's a misunderstanding about what it is, and that misunderstanding is that people have a much narrower and more antiquated view of what natural history is than how I see it. The term natural history actually is about 2,000 years old. It was coined by Pliny the Elder, a Roman philosopher, it was in Latin, of course, Historia Naturalis, which in Latin, interestingly, means not just natural history, but in Latin and Latin-derived languages like Spanish, Historia has two meanings. It means history, but it also means story. So people, that confusion oftentimes makes people think that it's really focused, natural history is only focused on the past. But in fact, it's really focused on the story of nature, which of course includes ourselves. And so I think, you know, instead of being something that's focused only on the past, I see natural history as being crucially important in this present moment, every moment of our lives. So the story of nature, of course, is a broad term, and really there's an infinite number of stories of nature at any given moment in any given place. So what you'd find, and in the literature, you'll find many different definitions of natural history, but most of them, they all have their strengths, but most of them, in my mind, are still too narrow, because most contemporary ones, that is, because they tend to look at only one aspect of natural history, which is the sort of scientific aspect, and oftentimes see it as sort of a subset of biological or ecological science. And that's incredibly important. I think natural history is the roots and the foundation of good biological and ecological science, but it's also, instead of being something that's, you know, just a narrow subset of biology, it's actually, in my mind, something that's much larger than science alone, because it's, and natural history is really the ultimate integrative discipline, you might say, you know, integrating art, science, humanities. In fact, that was the tagline of the Natural History Institute, actually, integrating art, science, and humanities. So so over the years, I ended up sort of coining my own definition of natural history, which is sort of more expansive than most others you would encounter, which is a practice of intentional and focused attentiveness and receptivity to the more than human world guided by honesty and accuracy. And so a couple of things maybe to highlight about that is that, you know, and you asked about practice. And so by emphasizing that it's a practice, you might say that natural history is a verb, not a noun. In other words, it is the doing. It's and if you wanted to boil that definition down to its core, it really is just the practice of paying attention to the world that we live in. And you know, when you stop and think of it that way, it becomes clear that natural history is a fundamental human practice. In fact, it's to the extent that you accept that definition, then it becomes clearly true that there has never been human beings in the world without the practice of natural history, because it was fundamental to our very survival. You know, paying attention to when plants, you know, fruits ripened to eat, when migratory animals that were hunted could be expected to pass through, when which animals were dangerous, which animals could be eaten, and so on and so forth. And so natural history has always been part of who we are. In fact, that's partly why I think it never needed to be defined. It was just being alive.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have, I think, a crisis today, because we live in a moment. There's never been a moment in the history of our species when natural history was practiced less, like by a smaller percentage of the human species, you might say. And I think that it's not coincidental that that coincides, that lack of natural history practice coincides with an upswing in all sorts of dysfunctions within our species. Antisocial behavior, violence, depression, anxiety, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, you got right to the core of it, and I appreciate that so much, because in biomimicry too, this connection to the natural world is so crucial, and it's kind of the underlying foundation upon which we build this practice of learning from nature and understanding nature. Mm-hmm. Natural history is so important to that. Yet at the same time, we are so distant from it now. Many of
right.
us are so distant from it.
Right, right. So we have to remind ourselves, not necessarily you and I, Lily, but remind ourselves as a collective species of why this is important and how. And I think it helps us in so many ways. So more recently, some of my work has been trying to convince people why, even if you don't particularly care about birds or butterflies or plants, that you should still be involved in this practice, because it's actually good for you in terms of your both physical and emotional health. But that's maybe another discussion. But
yeah.
So.
And the practice of, in our cases, yours for many, many years, much longer than mine. I'm just starting out my own kind of education journey. And I think the power in facilitating that sort of connection to nature. And you do have done a lot of these in-person trips, and my, you know, in my own experience, I've taken natural history field quarter at Santa Cruz, which totally changed my life. And these experiences are so foundational to how we see the world and how we interact with the world and what we do beyond, you know, just the screens that we interact with or the jobs we have. And so I'd love for you to speak about kind of your own experiences in the natural history field and education kind of path.
Well, I think I would suggest virtually every other human being in the history of the world began life interested in it, because it's part of our, I think it's deep in our genes, for the reasons I mentioned earlier about our, you know, survival adaptiveness and so on. But we're born to pay attention to the world around us and to be curious about it. And if anybody doubts that, I would just, you know, challenge you to find a young toddler anywhere in the world, any cultural group, any racial group, whatever, who doesn't, you know, process the world around them, picking up stones, looking at leaves, tasting, smelling, and so on. It's who we are. And yet, too often, and across cultural divides, we oftentimes lose that relatively early in so many cultures. And sometimes our cultures actively teach us that, oh, this is no longer important. That's just something you do when you're a kid, mm-hmm. which is a tragic mistake, I think. So in my own case, I attribute a lot of my nurturing of my curiosity to my mother and my family in general. My mother was a gardener and always had beautiful flowers in our yard and would sort of bring them in and talk about them and show them. And then one other wonderful thing that they did when I was a little kid, starting when I was actually age 3, my family went on a camping trip to a different national park every summer and just got immersed in it. And so that was formative. Obviously, not everybody has the opportunity to do those things. But this was before, that was very common, you know, before there was RVs and whatnot.
Right.
But the, since I, you know, this was back in the late Pleistocene or so. But the, but then also, I think, regrettably, too similar to a lot of people, I kind of stopped doing it for a while throughout the latter part of my childhood for an all too common reason, I think, which is I didn't have any peers or mentors at that time outside of my family that sort of thought it was cool. And so, whereas when I was 6 or 7, I was really into birds, especially, but, you know, nature in general. By the time I was 10 or 12, I was doing other things, and it wasn't until the beginning of my college years that I sort of fell in with a group of naturalist friends who re-engaged me with it, and then pretty quickly I was head over heels back in love with the world, and have been ever since. And that led me to just kind of fling myself into any kind of academic experiences that gave me opportunity, but and then also work experiences and just life experiences in general. I actually started college as a political philosophy major, and was actively avoiding taking any science classes until a friend actually convinced me to take a field botany course the spring of my second year of college, and that course just blew my mind. And the knowledge that I was gaining was so visceral and so tangible compared to, you know, studying Marx or whatever that I had been doing. And I just kind of fell for it and ended up doing more and more of that. And then ended up getting into sort of a number of field biology research jobs, both with private conservation groups and with the federal government. Those involved mostly working with marine mammals and also with marine birds in Alaska, Washington State, and Maine. And then somewhere in there, I started working as a naturalist for the National Park Service in the North Cascades, and then a close friend of mine and I co-founded a wonderful organization up there called the North Cascades Institute, which was basically trying to bring natural history education was long before I'd come up with this definition, but that's really what we were trying to do is foster this kind of expansive view of connecting with the world there. And that organization is still going strong. And then more and more teaching and education became sort of my chosen craft and my chosen pathway a lot. And so both with the general public and then with college students, and as well through a number of different paths, including the Natural History Institute that I mentioned earlier.
Wonderful.
And still doing some research along the way, some of which was very applied along the way. For example, I got really kind of, you know, to use the technical term, pissed off about the impacts of livestock grazing on arid lands of the West, mm-hmm. and did a lot of publication and writing and research about that, etc. But yeah, natural history was always the spark that kind of lit up the world for me.
Yeah.
Which I guess is one other thing I would want to emphasize is, and I think you used this term earlier, is I've come to think of natural history like an alternative definition is that it's the practice of falling in love with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, as you well know, you know, anytime you just focus on whether it's a particular organism or a group of organisms or a place or whatever, it just becomes more and more miraculous. And it's like that just the mystery and the beauty just unfolds and opens itself up to us. It's kind of like, and you know, you might say that natural history is sort of like an open-ended invitation, you know, to engage with the world, to embrace the world. And it's as such, it makes us feel better.
Yeah.
And because it connects us with one another. And I know, I'm sure, like in your field quarter experience, and in many similar experiences that we have both had, when you're doing that kind of practice sort of with a group of peers, it's those are really deeply connecting human relationships as well. You know, my closest friends in the world are people that I have practiced natural history with.
I agree.
Yeah, and so that's an antidote to some of the things that bedevil us in the world these days.
Yeah, antidote is a good word for it. And I think something that reminds me a lot of my love for the natural world is like the humility that it brings
mm-hmm.
us. And you mentioned that a lot in one of my favorite books, Nature, Love, Medicine, which is this collection mm-hmm. of essays. And I'm actually, when I, you know, splice all these together, I'm going to read a little quote from it. But the mm-hmm. there's lots of quotes from all these essays about how, you know, this love for the natural world and observing the natural world and attention to the natural world brings out this humility and reminds us that we are not alone here. And there's this, you know, incredible array of organisms and ecosystems in which we live and share this space with. And they're all really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for the kind word on the book. But also, yes. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think humility is just cornerstone importance in this. And there's really not much. It'd be hard to do something else that would make you that would foster humility within any one of us, mm-hmm. you know, more than the practice of natural history, where we see all these other types of living systems that are stronger than us, better than us, smarter than us,
mm-hmm.
cleverer than us, whatever. And you know, humility, of course, I think is not only healthy for us as individuals, but it's good for the world. You might even say that that fostering humility is, on some level, is a political act,
yeah.
because the world needs more of that. There's all too many examples right now of the lack of humility going bonkers in the world. So.
And it's connected to so many different aspects in how we see the world and how we perceive the world as well. And it's, you know, the connection I have to biomimicry too, and that this practice has been foundational for my practice in biomimicry, is that sense of humility of everything,
mm-hmm.
all of the solutions we need for our survival already exist in the natural world. Nature has solved for all of the challenges we're currently facing in so many areas of life. And we just need to learn to look, to observe, to understand, to be in relationship with.
Yes, exactly. Well said. And yeah, I mean, and so much of the practice, I mean, natural history is an observational practice. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have that word receptivity as part of my definition, is it's paying attention and being willing to have your preconceptions shattered, being willing to really listen, to really look. So
yeah. And in that sense, one of my big questions for you was, what does it mean to have a reciprocal relationship to nature? And I think we've started to hint at this, you know, by being humble and observing nature, but then what does that look like on a two-way street?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think there's a big zone of overlap, you might say, between the notion of humility and the notion of reciprocity.
Yeah.
Because we can't be reciprocal if we don't have some humility that we can't believe that we have all the answers or that we are the only thing that matters and be reciprocal.
Right.
But the way that it manifests, I think, can be in many, many different ways. So so we can be reciprocal with the world by, you know, it involves giving back in some kind of way, fundamentally. And so that can, I don't think there's any one way that people do that. You putting together all the time and energy it takes to do this podcast is a form of reciprocity for all the gifts that you've been given. You know, starting organizations that help other people do us, like part of what I've done would be another example, but so is a very more tangible things, you know, planting a garden or working on a ecological restoration project, or even things that are, you know, just, you know, donating to groups if you don't have the time or the inclination or the physical capacity to do that sort of thing one yourself, then supporting others that are doing it. So I think there's just many, many different ways of being reciprocal, but the acknowledgement that it matters is what is crucial.
Yeah, and such a important aspect in the biomimicry world as well. It's not just about, you know, in our sense of like taking from nature or learning from nature and then doing something with it, but not actually giving back to nature or ensuring that nature and the habitat in which this organism lived endures, you know? And so I think there's
absolutely
a bit of that in biomimicry as well, of like, okay, I'm learning from this organism or this process or this ecosystem. How can I ensure that my actions in turn make sure that this organism exists and continues to exist and thrives, and it's a design that benefits both? And I think that's a really literal way to see it as well. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, another example might be sort of ecotourism. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people who are who have some means and who are fascinated, let's say, by birds, and so they want to travel somewhere specifically to see, you know, more, you know, whole another panoply of birds in some other part of the world. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that, but the more responsible way, and you might say the more reciprocal way, would be to do it very carefully and in a way that makes sure that the money that you are spending there is going, as you say, to support the endurance of the place and especially of the people who are there taking care of the place.
Exactly.
So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and that's something I think. There's so many levels of caring for the natural world, and I think in our own spaces, like, education is a big one. But on a really simple level, it can look like bringing plant and bird books when you go on hikes and introducing your friends and family to loving and falling in love with the natural world on a different level than just hiking to go see the views from the top of a mountain, right?
Yeah.
I think talking familiar with the naturalist taste, it's like every 5 feet there's a cool plant or a cool bug we have to look at.
Right. Yeah, I have a bumper sticker on my car that says, "I break for natural history."
I want one. And I think, there's just like, there's this incredible spectrum and they're all equally important. And starting from where you are at, and I think that's a big point to why I want to do this podcast too, is, you know, this is a place for people to start, to get inspired and excited about the natural world. and beyond, you know, what we can take from it, but what we can learn and how we can be in relationship to it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, because the practice of natural history is welcoming. You might say it's egalitarian, because every person is literally born with the capacity, as we discussed earlier, and the drive to do it. And it does not take special training to do it. If toddlers can do it, we can all do it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, for example, ecological science, which has been a big chunk of my professional life has been involved in ecology and conservation biology worlds, all of which is great and really, really important. But that, some of that, if you were to look at the practice of that, that could be kind of daunting for people in the general public if they don't have the background in it. But looking at the birds, just as we're speaking, there's several species of birds landing in the feeder right outside my window, or just the garden that we might have, what day is the first crocus blooming, in the spring, or, you know, there's just all this wonder, and contrary to some people's views, you know, that kind of thing happens in big urban areas as well. It is available in big urban areas as well as anywhere else. So it doesn't take fancy tools or anything. In fact, that's part of the reason I think that part of the history of it in the last few decades, unfortunate part of the history, I think, is that whereas it used to be a cornerstone of higher education in this country, in fact, before World War II, training in natural history went under the rubric of nature study, was actually a required part of the training of teachers in many places, in many states. But after World War II, and with the development of the space race and exciting developments in molecular biology and so on, all of which is great, but natural history got more and more marginalized, and as time went on, natural historians tended to be culled from the faculties of especially big research universities, so that you can go to lots of major universities which have great academic reputations, and they don't do very much of this. And I think part of the reason for that is that natural history is so welcoming and requires so little, so that in the infrastructure of academia, as you know, there's a lot of pressure for people to get grants and so on, and it's harder to bring in a big grant to a university if all you need to do it is a few pairs of binoculars or what have you, as opposed to mass spectrometers or whatever it might be.
That's why I love the idea of like a natural history field porter, or the Natural History Institute that does these field excursions in places, mm-hmm. in beautiful places all over, but many in Arizona, and these really incredible ecosystems, in that it's cross-disciplinary, it's interdisciplinary. Anybody can practice and anybody can get, excited about it. And I think it should be in all of these university programs for students, like at UC Santa Cruz, the mm-hmm. Natural History Field Quarter was something you applied to, and you could be in any discipline, and it was for, juniors and seniors. And it was an entire semester or quarter at Santa Cruz. And we just spent that doing research and traveling around these different research reserves in California. And it was so crucial to how I perceive the world, that I am like on this mission to try to get programs like that in a lot of other universities, because students, and especially in the academic sense, there's just so many departments that are very siloed, that are very separate, and I think there's been a whole evolution for that to happen in academia, but I'm hoping that practices like natural history and biomimicry can be kind of like a disruptive force, so to speak, in that space.
Yeah, well, I hear ye. I agree with you completely, of course. And, I have my own versions of that. I'm real familiar with Field Quarter at UCSC and know many people who had similar experiences to you, so that's a wonderful thing. And, my undergraduate degree was from Evergreen State College in Washington, which also was very, very field-oriented. And then my years teaching at Prescott College, there was only a handful of courses that I taught over 29 years that did not have a field component to it. And there's, many other schools. There's a vertebrate biology field course at UC Berkeley has been going, continuously for over 100 years now, and that has had a similar impact on a lot of people. Many school, College of the Atlantic in Maine, where I have good friends that teach, you know, and it's that there's a lot of places that are still doing it, and I do see some hopeful signs of a resurgence in this, especially within the sciences, in academic sciences. For example, you know, a number of years ago, with a colleague, we proposed a symposium on the importance of natural history at the ESAME, which is the Ecological Society of America, which is the largest group of professional ecologists in the world. So it's actually an international group. And initially that was rejected because they said, and natural history is no longer the cutting edge of ecology. Mm. And yet, so it got downgraded to a different category, the symposium. And we put this thing together, and it was like standing room only, and just so much excitement. And so out of that experience came a National Science Foundation grant that we put together a series of workshops around the country. And 2 years later, we went back to the ESA meeting to report on this. And by that point, it had already changed quite a bit in terms of the response and the receptiveness to it. So I do think that there is some change, but that's even just within the sciences. So what you mentioned the arts and so on at the field quarter, and I think that's really important to emphasize, is that natural history, what I mentioned before, it's sort of like the ultimate integrative discipline in a way, because everything has its place. If natural historia or historia naturalis is about the story of nature, and you might say there's many different ways of telling good stories, and science is one of them, and visual arts, performing arts, literature, you know, all these things are other effective ways. Podcasts. So, yeah.
And I think that's a good point, too, because things like podcasts and these spaces where folks can get interested in natural history and get a little bit of experience so that they can go out in their own ecosystem, their own biome, to do that research and to explore nature and build their own relationship with nature is so important, because I feel like there's a lot of disconnection that's happening in today's world, even though we are, quote unquote, more connected than ever with technology and social media,
right,
et cetera. We are actually feeling more and more disconnected. And you mentioned this in your book, too, the Nature, Love, Medicine, and how it's all connected to our wellness, our mentality, and our place in this world. And I think there's just so many deep connections that, you know, I don't know if we have time to get into all today, but there's just endless benefits to getting out in nature and building that relationship.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And that's probably a whole nother session here, but
yeah.
but you know, you and I were both involved in a national, we called it a confluence, a couple of years ago, just right before the pandemic, called Reciprocal Healing, which was focused on exactly this. And I guess suffice it to say, there's a rapidly growing literature from medical science, from psychology, and so on, about the direct benefits for human health, both physical and emotional, from immersion in nature. I mean, to the point that now even, nations like Canada are allowing physicians to prescribe, you know, time in nature prescribing free passes to national parks and all sorts of things like that. So it's really not arguable anymore that this is true. And it's kind of one of those things that's like, well, yeah, you know, it seems pretty obvious, but sort of like the machinations of sort of academic, thinking and verification and so on have come around to make it pretty inarguable that that's true.
Yeah, and I'm hoping we can start to integrate those findings and research on many different levels as well. You know, in the education space is a big one. I know teaching at a university, especially in the last 2 years, it's been a lot of online work. And so students are sitting in front of their computer for much of the day and night. And I know I was doing that for my graduate school program for a lot of it. But the difference with me was that with the biomimicry graduate program, the assignments asked you to go outside, right? It was all kind of place-based experiential learning that you would then come back and do the discussions and group work. But we were asked to go outside. And so I'm doing a lot of that and trying to build in that to my class, because I know a lot of other, you know, classes don't necessarily do that. It's a huge part of my class is a nature journal and getting students outside. And I think that's going to be more and more important in our education system. You know, we're starting to move back to in-person, but it's more than just even the classroom space. It's going out into nature, whether that be the sidewalk outside and, you know, the little park on the corner, wherever that may be, especially in big cities, that recognition that we need to integrate natural history and going out into nature into so many different aspects of life and education.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of my big questions for you is, what are some of your favorite ways to reconnect and connect with nature?
Well, I think the answer to this would be really different for any person, because we just all have different sort of emotional responses to different kind of things. So I, for my whole life, have been really bird oriented. You know, just there's a I aspire to be a generalist in terms of natural history, and that to pay attention and know something about all kinds of different critters and plants, but birds have always been something special to me. So that become that virtually anywhere I am, whether it's in a city at a conference or whether it's out traveling, you know, the birds or something, I'm paying special attention to. I can't even help it, you know. Plants as well, but you know, just trying to go for a walk every day if I can, and you know, paying attention to those things, seeing what changed since the previous day, all those kind of things are part of my practice, which at this point it's not even necessarily conscious that I'm choosing to do that. It's just become part of life. Journaling in different kind of ways, which you know, that can be keeping more, you know, rigorous scientific notes, or it can be writing haiku, or it can be writing, you know, drawing a picture or whatever. Yeah, those are the kind of things that I tend to do on a regular basis.
I love the connection to birds. I am an aspiring birder. I'm definitely less practiced, but it's something that once you begin to notice, and I think you mentioned this, it's just kind of becomes a habit and not even like you notice you're practicing it, but birds, one, are everywhere. So you can kind of connect in that way in any ecosystem all over the world. They change, they migrate, they're, you know, there's a connection to seasonality there and cyclical nature, which I really love. And then also kind of the challenge of it for me,
yeah,
birding is like, oh, what was that? I saw it for half a second. I think this is what the under, you know, feathers look like. This is what its wing shape was like. And I think part of it's like the puzzle of it that I'm really interested in. Not as good with the binoculars yet, but I'm working on it.
Well, it's so much fun. I mean, and that's another piece of it. It's just fun. And I agree with everything you said. And the other thing I would add about birds is that more than any other group of animals in the world, they actually use the same senses that we do. So, because they behave, I mean, their behavior, like ours, is based on sight and sound more than anything else. And that enables us to sort of enter their world in a way that we're not able to enter the world of say, like any other mammal species. Even though we're mammals, we have a really undeveloped sense of smell compared to any other mammal. And so there's certain things, you know, I could sit here and watch a rodent or whatever all day long, but I would never be able to really perceive what it's perceiving, and I can do that more closely with a bird.
That's a really
so that good that provides an opportunity for connection too.
Definitely. All right, and one of my other big questions for you is, what are some book recommendations or any other resources really that you're excited about or kind of have on your bookshelf or nearby that you would recommend to those getting, you know, just starting to get their feet wet, so to speak, in the natural history practice?
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, subversive activity can be just bringing along a field guide or two when you're going out hiking. So, I mean, I think that that really field guides are this incredible gift that's been handed us by our sort of intellectual ancestors, you might say, where people have meticulously put together all this and collated information and drawings and everything to, so that we can actually have a book to the birds of North America or Western North America or whatever geography we're talking about, or the plants or the insects or what have you. And so I'd say the first thing I would say is just getting a couple field guides to whatever group of organisms kind of turns you on. And many places, not all places, but many places have somebody, some naturalist somewhere along the line has made an attempt to write down something about a place. And again, that could be very specific or very general. So for example, there's a great book on the natural history of the Sonoran Desert where you spent a few years.
Yeah, I have that.
And, yeah, it's a great that's book. Awesome. And there's things like that for many regions, not all regions. And so that's a great job for all of us to take on, is writing, you know, filling in those gaps. But then there's also wonderful books about sort of more about the practice or the history of natural history or the sort of, you might say, the philosophy or the approach of it. I'd probably be remiss if I didn't mention a couple of my books that try to do that. Well, I mean, one I already mentioned, Nature, Love, Medicine, and an earlier book called The Way of Natural History, both of which are anthologies bringing together a lot of different voices. One of the contributors to both of those is a wonderful, wonderful woman, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who I suspect many of the folks listening will be familiar with already, who is a Native American ecologist, and she has several wonderful books, but one, the best known, is called Braiding Sweet Grass, which really delves deeply into this idea of reciprocity and humility and paying attention. I could go on and on.
Oh man, Breeding Sweetgrass is probably one of my favorite books of all time. The way that she writes about our connection. I mean, it just had me hooked. I've read it a few times now and recommend it to everybody.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and Robin's a wonderful person. Well,
you met her. I had lunch with her one of the days at Reciprocal Healing Confluence, and it was just really grounding. It was really powerful.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And that just reminds me, too, one more thing I just want to say, that this really beautiful kind of perspective to have, and I think natural history brings this in so well and is also really important for biomimicry, and Robin writes about it in her book, is this idea of kind of respect for a place when you walk a new hike or you're exploring a new area, having, you know, some field guides or knowing the names of the things that you are sharing a space with is really important to kind of starting that relationship, and building that respect. And I think the respect for place is something that's very rooted in my own practice, and that's why I think I'm so driven to understand new plants and animals and birds, whatever it may be, wherever I'm hiking, which takes time and takes practice, but I think that's important.
Yeah, it's that's a really good point. And, you know, naming for many people is a really important part of the natural history practice, including, I think, both of us.
Yeah.
And some people, occasionally you hear somebody say, well, that's just, you know, those are just fake names, or that's, you know, those are made up names or whatever. And that's all true.
Yep.
But nevertheless, by learning the name of something, for one thing, just pragmatically, it opens up all kinds of opportunities for learning more about it. We can look things up, et cetera, et cetera. But also, just as you're saying, it demonstrates respect. Just like if instead of calling you Lily, if I just said, hey, you, you know, that it's a different kind of relationship. And some people, in certain contexts, it's incredibly important and handy to learn the scientific names, but in many other cases, that's not important. But again, that practice of respect that you're talking about and that Robin talks about so eloquently
exactly.
Is what's so important.
All right, last question. Tom, what's giving you hope right now?
I just had an online conversation with colleagues from around the world about this a couple of weeks ago, about exactly that question. Well, you know, obviously we're living through some really challenging times in many, many ways. But I mean, really, more than anything is, I mean, I'd say the overarching thing that does give me hope really is the practice of natural history. It's, you know, I can read the, you know, I can get immersed. I'm kind of a political junkie and you know, feel like it's also a responsibility mm-hmm. to know what's going on in the world. Yeah. But, you know, you can burrow yourself pretty deep, pretty quickly. And then, you know, you walk outside and there's a beautiful bird at the feeder, or just the feel of the sunlight on your face, or whatever sort of gesture the world is making towards to remind us that there is this larger embracing world beyond the world of human conflict and trouble. And so really the practice of natural history keeps rejuvenating my sense of hope, you know, on a daily basis. And I can't even imagine how I'd be feeling right now without that. And then also just people like yourself doing good work in the world and keep moving forward and being creative. And so actually this human creativity yeah. gives me a lot of hope, and the arts give me hope. And many times those things are broadly overlapping categories.
Right.
So it's oftentimes people who practice natural history are creative and hopeful. So.
Yeah. Oh, beautifully said. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I think it's really great.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'd like to end with one of my favorite quotes from Nature Love Medicine. Natural history combats arrogance, tackles despair. Attentiveness to the world around us engenders humility and open-mindedness. It humanizes and grounds us by offering a larger perspective on the world. Humility, so sorely needed in our social and political discourses, can only be taught through modeling. Some human elders do a fine job of this, but immersion in the complexity, unpredictability, and occasionally the ferociousness of the natural world almost always teaches humility. Natural history makes us healthier as individuals and collectively as societies. Engagement with the beauty and power of nature brings out our best behavior, supports our best selves. The expansive attentiveness of natural history is ultimately hopeful. For we're all wired to pay attention to nature. Human consciousness developed in natural history's forge. Our patterns of attention were sharpened as we watched for danger and sought food. Practicing natural history is our natural inclination. We are all born with the capacity to attend the world with wonder. Just watch any child. And so recovering a collective sense of stewardship is within our grasp. When we love the world, we can love ourselves. And vice versa.